Okay, thanks everyone. Thanks for being here, such a cold day. So I will be talking about neutron stars today and neutron star binaries and what happens when they coalesce as far as gravitational waves are concerned and all the interesting things we can learn with them about the universe. So the protagonists of the story today will of course be neutron stars, which are really remarkable astrophysical objects. They're really the last winning battle for stable matter before just total gravitational collapse into a black hole. And this is just a narrative depiction of what happens inside a neutron star, where you start from the outside, from the crust, with nuclei whose properties are more or less well understood. And as you transition towards the cores of neutron stars, where the densities are higher, the temperatures are really low, the energies are really high, at this point, matter, the matter we are used to starts falling apart, nuclei fall apart. And if you reach all the way to the center of a neutron star, at this point, we just do not know what matter looks like and how matter behaves. So in this talk, I will argue that in order to understand this kind of systems, in order to understand neutron stars, in order to understand their coalescences, what we need to do is we need to combine our very best knowledge of a very wide variety of physics fields, from astrophysics and nuclear physics down to statistics and our very best data analysis. So the interiors of these neutron stars are, I find, really remarkable places where the microscopic properties of very dense stable matter is in a direct correspondence with macroscopic properties of large astrophysical objects. You can see here on the left the pressure density relation inside a neutron star. This is called the neutron star equation of state. And you'll see a number of different models, number of different suggestions that nuclear physicists have made for what this equation of state is. And on the right is the mass radius relation of the corresponding neutron star created by these types of equations of state. So you have densities of the order of the nuclear saturation density interactions around femtometers, distances, corresponding to the sizes of large objects that are of the order of kilometers. We have 18 orders of magnitude difference, and phenomena that affect these 18 orders of magnitude are of the same physical origin. This is...
Here, for all these graphs, the slope seems to be the same, which is the speed of sound for the matter, for the neutron star. What is the speed of sound that is...
So these models are constrained, so the speed of sound is less than the speed of light, so they're causal. But each of these models predicts different speed of sound. It just has to be, usually we assume it has to be smaller than the speed of light. So the other thing to notice here, apart from this wide range of scales, is that the radius, the possible radius of neutron stars are between 10 kilometers to up to 15 or maybe even 16 kilometers. This is a huge uncertainty. This is almost 100% uncertainty in the sizes of these objects. And these objects are very common and very important for astrophysics. From a large number of phenomena we want to study, from supernova when they're born to coalescences of neutron stars where they die, and a large number of questions we want to ask, we want to answer about the universe, like the heavy element production, short gamma ray bursts, they're all affected by what happens inside neutron stars and by our lack of knowledge about the properties of matter inside neutron stars. So in August, a few months ago, the first binary neutron star coalescence was finally detected with gravitational waves by the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. And at the same time, it was also, the same coalescence was also observed with gamma rays and kilonova. And I'm sure you all heard and seen many talks about this remarkable discovery. But so I'm not going to describe today the specifics of what happened and how we analyzed the system and what we learned from it. But I will discuss a little bit what it means, what these gravitational waves mean. So here is what the gravitational wave from a binary neutron star coalescence looks like in the frequency domain. This is the spectrum of the wave. So you have the amplitude spectral density as a function of the frequency. And the two lines here are the sensitivities of the detectors, a design sensitivity, and at the time of the detection, approximately. And these lines here are the gravitational waves. I have plotted four different lines for four different colors. And the difference between those lines is the equation of state, is the properties of matter inside the neutron stars. So early on, the spectrum is just a line. The two neutron stars are really far apart. The internal composition does not matter. For all we know, they could be black holes or they could be point particles. So all equations of state predict the same evolution in this in spiral phase. As the two neutron stars get close together, their internal composition starts to matter, what we call the Leyden spiral. And at this point, you start seeing differentiations in the signal, in the resulting signal we see in the detector, depending on the equation of state of neutron stars. And eventually, the two stars will merge, they will get close together, they will collide with each other, and they will form a remnant star that keeps emitting more and more energy because it's very unstable, which looks like this phase that we call the post-merger. So this is a very long phase where the equation of state doesn't matter. Here, the equation of state starts matter, though the variation between the different signals is not very large. But the most dramatic variation is here, in this very complicated phase. So for the rest of the talk, I will describe these three phases. I will describe what the gravitational waves emitted from these three phases look like. I will discuss a little bit what we do with them, what we can use them for, and a few interesting things that we can do with them. And looking ahead at the end, what the future probably holds for binary star coalescences.
Sorry, on the last one, did you show us the actual data? I didn't understand that. These are simulations, these colors?
The different colors are simulations for a binary that is consistent with 170817, the one we saw in August. The only thing here that is real data is the sensitivity of the gravitational wave detector in August. The others are just our best guesses for what the data could have looked like.
But there was data, right?
There was data.
It's not here, right?
It's not here.
Okay.
I promise there was data.
Okay.
Well, that's what they told me. They gave me data. I analyzed it, I promise. Okay. So let's start with the in-spiral. So this is what the gravitational wave looks like from two in-spiral interstars. Actually, these are two gravitational waves, a blue in the background and orange in the foreground. So you can already see why we usually just don't plot this. They're really, really long. They're so long and dense that you can't really see cycles in them. The reason is that we start observing these systems when they're about 400 kilometers apart, and over the next 10,000 cycles and over 10 minutes, they get close together. So which is why you can't really see any individual cycles. There's a very, very long signal that lasts for about order minutes. So in this phase, when the two neutron stars are far apart and they're slowly orbiting around each other, I argued that because they're so far apart, they don't know about their internal composition of each other. For all they know, they could be orbiting around a point particle. So this is what is called the effective point particle description. So we don't think that the properties of matter inside neutron stars affect this phase. So let's get a little bit to the colors. And I'm showing two waveforms here. There is a blue in the background where the amplitude is monotonically increasing with time. And there is an orange in the foreground where the amplitude has these interesting modulations. The difference between the two is the so-called spin precession. What that means is that if the two bodies have spins, they have spin orbital angular momenta, in general relativity, this spins interact with each other, causing modulations, causing the binary to precess in space. I will show you a simulation for how that works. This was performed by the Simulating Extreme Spacetimes Collaboration, and these are just two black holes with spins orbiting around each other. And the vectors on the black holes you see are just their spin angular momentum. And when I play the simulation, you'll see how the two bodies do not stay on one plane, orbiting around each other on one plane, but they change, the plane changes orientation.
So these are black holes, not neutron stars? Or?
These are black holes, not neutron stars, but at this phase, I argue that black holes behave pretty much the same way as neutron stars.
Neutron stars could have higher spin than.
Sorry?
The neutron stars could have higher spin or higher angular momentum than black holes, couldn't
they? So usually black holes can have higher spins because neutron stars, the normal equation of state do not support really large spins. So the angular momenta of black holes are larger because at some point neutron stars are falling apart if they rotate too fast. So this is just an example of black holes to see what the effect looks like. So they start orbiting around each other. They don't stay in one plane. The plane moves in space. The very spins, these vectors on the black holes, do change orientation. At some point, the thing merges.
That was just 5 cycles, right?
That was a fairly short signal, yes. Yes, which is why I'm not showing neutron stars here, because we cannot simulate 10,000 cycles, and I'm showing black holes. Okay, so why am I discussing spin precession? First of all, because it's a very interesting relativistic effect. We've seen spin precession on Earth, we've seen it with gyroscopes around Earth, but at the same time, we do want to see this effect from black holes and neutron stars and really large astrophysical extreme relativistic objects. But besides that, there's also a very practical reason. And the reason is that when we have a gravitational wave signal, and we think it's from two black holes, or we think it's from two neutron stars, the best way to go about analyzing the data is by assuming that we know what we're looking for. So what this means is that if you have some data like that, like the blue, and you know your brains are probably pretty good and they already know what this is, you already know that this is a sinusoid plus some random stuff on top. Computers do not work like that. Computers need to be taught to figure out what this is. So what we do in practice, we take a large number of sinusoids and compare them against the data and find the one that fits the data the best. Or you know, we find the few that fit the data reasonably well enough. This means that we need good models, that we need the sinusoids that I'm overplotting. We need models, we need templates for what the gravitational wave looks like. And if you want to accurate models for what it looks like, you also need to include precession. You need to include this complicated motion, these complicated interactions between the spins of the two bodies. So despite being a very complicated problem that took many years to solve, can probably confidently say that to a large degree we have solved this problem. I spent a considerable amount of my graduate studies working on this problem, on constructing analytical models from spin processing systems. And I won't go into the details of how we do this, how we describe precessional motion, but if people are interested in this relativistic effect, please feel free to ask more questions. But in the meantime, I will go back to the general theme of what we can learn from a gravitational wave signal about nature. So how does spin precession help in anything? How does it help us learn more about the system we just observed? So a big issue in gravitational wave astrophysics and source characterization for a long time has been the so-called mass spin degeneracy or the mass spin correlation. What this means is that if you have a gravitational wave signal and want to measure both its mass and its spin, then you're in trouble because the two are correlated. So the presence of one ruins the measurement of the other. So here's an example for how this works. So here's the spin and here's the mass. And this is from a simulated signal, just a signal that I made and injected into the data, which is not what happened in August. But and then analyze the signal. And all the dots plotted here are possible solutions for what the system is, for what the properties of the system are. In other words, this is a scatter plot of the two-dimensional posterior distribution. And the extent and the structure of this posterior is what a correlation is. It means that if you want to measure the mass, the uncertainty in the mass is all that. If, on the other hand, you didn't have a spin, you knew that the spin is zero, then the uncertainty is this smaller extent here. If you knew that the spin is 0.15, it's smaller here. This has been a known problem for a long time, and this is something that we knew for a long time that would cause trouble in our ability to measure mass and to measure spins.
Is this also for black hole binaries?
Yes.
Is this the combined mass? This is the mass of one of the black holes of the combined mass.
This is the mass of one black hole. But you can make similar plots with different mass parameters, different mass combinations.
You can't have a mass bigger than three.
Which brings me to my next point. So once we have some, we know that this problem is caused by spins. But we know that spins are complicated. They perform this complicated motion that I just described in the form of precession. So once I had constructed a precessing model, I want to go see if we can, if this can help in any way with this degeneracy. And indeed, it does break it, and it does help us extract the masses better. So here's a similar plot like before, but right now we have the two masses, the masses of the two bodies in the binary, and with two simulated signals, one here and one here. And these are, again, the posterior distributions, scatter plot of the posterior distributions. And they all fall on pretty much what is a one-dimensional curve. You've all heard this before, that there is one combination of the masses called the Chirp mass that we measure really well. And what we mean by measuring really well is that it's all points for an almost one-dimensional line. But the extent of this line is the mass ratio, is how well you can measure the individual masses of the two binary components. So as just heard, general relativity and causality put a bound of about 3.2 solar masses, a maximum bound for the mass of the neutron star. Everything above that needs to be a black hole. It cannot be a neutron star. Everything below that could be a neutron star, could be a black hole. So if we go and analyze the data we have, assuming there are no spins, which is a very bad assumption, everything is spinning, but let's go and assume this for a while, we get a posterior that looks like that. It's the blue dots, and I hope you can see them.
The maximum mass ever observed for neutron star is two solar masses observed.
Yes, from binaries. There's some suggestions from X-ray binaries that of about a 2.7 solar mass, but they're not on a very firm ground. The two neutron star observation is probably the best accepted. So there is a difference between what's the maximum allowed by general relativity and the maximum allowed by nuclear physics. So most equations state have a maximum of about 2.5, maybe 2, so somewhere in here. So if we see something that's 2.8 solar masses, it's not like we know it's a neutron star. It will really challenge nuclear physics to model this. But to get back to how spins help analyzing these systems, if you don't assume spins, you can measure things that well. But spins exist. Everything is spinning. So if we do include spins, if we include constant spins that do not precess, then this correlation, this degeneracy I just described, really ruins your measurement. And you have an uncertainty that goes from here all the way up to here behind the red and behind the blue dots. And this is where the real problem begins, because you know that all these points cannot be neutron stars. These have to be black holes, which means that you could get confused and thinking that you just observed a black hole while you just observed two normal neutron stars. But if you do include precession, if you do model this relativistic effect of the interaction between the two spins, then you get much better measurement, which is the red extending behind the blue of the two masses, allowing you to distinguish between neutron stars and black hole in a much more confident way than if you did not include it. And if you had this entire uncertainty. So for 170817, we of course did this analysis back in September, and we did publish a plot like that, which is, again, the posterior distribution for the two masses. We did the analysis twice, allowing two different spin magnitudes. We assume that the neutron stars are spinning, are allowed to spin rapidly, and we assume that they're not allowed to spin rapidly, and they have fairly small spins. For those of you who don't speak relativistic spins, this is the conversion to period in milliseconds. And for this analysis, we did not use precession. We just assumed that the spins were there, but they were constant. They were just not changing orientation. And we have a large number of follow-up analysis on the way that should be published relatively soon. So to sum up, in the in-spiral phase, the two neutron stars are effectively point particles. It's at this phase that we get the most information out of the signal. We measure the masses, we measure the spins, we measure the sky location of the source, which allowed us to find the electromagnetic counterpart from 170817. And in order to understand this phase, I argued that we need very good models for what the signals look like. And I described how a relativistic effect, understanding a relativistic effect, allows us to get more information from these systems and understand these systems better. So moving on.
Go ahead.
You showed us the posterior distribution. So is it very sensitive to the prior that you put on it? How sensitive is it?
So you can already see that it's very sensitive to the spin prior, for example. If the spin prior goes all the way up to 0.89, this is the posterior. If it goes just to 0.05, this is the posterior. It's very sensitive on the spin prior. The mass ratio, the extent of this line, is very sensitive to the spin prior. On the other hand, you can see that both the blue and the red fall on kind of the same one-dimensional curve. So the chirp mass, which is what gives you this one-dimensional curve, is not sensitive to the prior. There are different things. Some things do depend on the prior, some do not, which is why we chose to show both.
Katarina, you said results on the way, are they using?
Yes.
Yes.
So I think two questions. One, is this chi, the way you define it, is this angular momentum in units of ms squared, like for black holes, or is it the, okay, it's the same definition?
Yes.
And the second question is, let's see. So I guess what is the motivation for highly spinning neutron stars? Because like the pulsars are spin down, and I guess with some exceptions, they spin down. So and then presumably this happens, takes billions of years for this to happen. So shouldn't they, all of them spin down to some very small?
The motivation was that we decided to at least include one analysis that was as astrophysically agnostic as possible. So yes, it would be fairly difficult to get such strongly, such rapidly spinning neutron stars. And usually also, for most equation states, neutron stars start breaking apart at some point above some rotational frequency. So by 0.89, they have already probably broken apart. But we wanted to be as agnostic as possible. At the end of the day, we don't even know if these were neutron stars. They could be black holes, for all we know.
Related to what you just said, so is the spin an independent parameter? Because tidal effects, for example, that probe the equation of state, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, so the signal, I guess you constrain the equation of state by looking at the waveform and looking at tidal effects from there. So, but the spin is also how high you can go on spin is also correlated with the equation of state. So here you treat it as an independent parameter. If you were to combine the two, wouldn't that constrain the range of spin? As you say, if it was spinning too fast, it would just blow apart.
Yes.
And that when that happens depends on the equation of state.
Yes. So in principle, the spins are related to the equation of state,
yeah.
And also the tides and everything. So let's get back to it in the next, back to this question in the next section. Well, I talk about what happens when tides start mattering in the waveform. So once they get close together, the internal composition, the equation of state starts mattering. And the way we analyze the in-spiral just described, we use these accurate models for the signal. And thanks to a lot of work from a lot of people, these models can be extended all the way to the late in-spiral when the two neutron stars are really close. So we can analyze the two phases together. And what follows, I will describe this common analysis and describe the kind of analysis we did to place some constraints on the equation of state. Yes?
Do you worry about the misalignment of the spins? Because six black hole events, they all have misaligned spins. The six black hole mergers. Kind. The spins are not aligned.
For five of the six black holes, we do not know, we don't even know if the black holes were spinning. Only one has evidence of a non-zero black hole. Then in all six black holes, we have not seen any indication of misalignment. Probably they are misaligned because being exactly aligned is impossible. But we have not seen evidence of this in any gravitational wave so far.
But they measured chi, the chi effective.
Right.
Which is the inner product of these two vectors.
Yes.
One is the spin mass weighted, and the other is the overhang and momentum. And they're close to zero for all six.
But that does not tell you if they are perpendicular or if the spin is small.
No, it just says that it could be misaligned.
Could be misaligned, or it could be that the spin is zero. We don't know. We haven't seen any definitive evidence yet. Okay. So late in spiral, where the two bodies start tidally interacting with each other. So I will show you two simulations, numerical relativity simulations, for the evolution of two neutron stars that are fairly close to each other, and they are evolving because of gravitational radiation emission. And the two pairs of neutron stars have here the same masses, the same initial parameters, the same position, same velocities. The only thing that changes between the two is the equation of state. So you can already see the difference. These are larger, these are smaller. So when they start playing the simulations, you see that the evolutions are different. These, because they are larger, they start tidally affecting each other much earlier. And they're not perfect spheres at the moment. They touch, they merge, and matter is ejected all over the place, and you have the post-merger phase. While here, they are still happily orbiting around each other, and now they finally merge and have the same similar merger and post-merger evolution. So in mathematical terms, what happens is that when you have two bodies that are close to each other, one tidally distorts the other. So the tidal field of one star induces a quadrupole moment on the other star. And this constant of proportionality is what we try to measure. It's called the tidal deformability, and it depends quite sensitively on the equation of state. So how easy or how difficult it is to deform a star is what we're trying to measure, and it's what depends on the equation of state. So, okay, so we want to measure this tidal deformability and learn something about the equation of state of neutron stars. But let's take a step back and
So there is a definition of this lambda in terms of P and rho.
Sorry?
There is a definition of this lambda in terms of P and rho.
Yes.
And it's like a universal definition.
It is a universal definition in the sense that you can write it down, but then depending on what the equation of state is, you get a different lambda. But there is a relation, and I will show it in a bit.
Okay.
I will plot it in a bit, at least. So let's take a step back and think a little bit more about equation of state and what we are trying to measure. So roughly speaking, if we want to characterize the kind of equation of state and trial models we are trying to study, we can use two criteria. The first criterion is what neutron stars are made of and what kind of matter is inside neutron stars, the internal composition of neutron stars. So The canonical choice for matter inside neutron stars is neutrons, protons, electrons, and muons. But nuclear physicists expect that when the densities are really high and the energies are really high at the cores of neutron stars, you can start having phase transitions. So we can start forming kaons or hyperons or even quark matter floating around freely inside neutron stars. And then besides just what kind of internal composition neutron stars have, equations of states are also characterized by how they decide to model the interactions between the matter inside these very dense stars. So nuclear physicists have proposed a large number of ways to do this, resulting in a large number of models. I showed you a plot of the pressure-density relation early on of different kinds of models. So you have equation of state models that use some method to model the interactions, the matter interactions inside neutron stars, and assume some composition for what neutron star matter looks like. And there's a very large number of so-called normal matter equations of state. And there are equations of state that assume that hyperons are formed inside neutron stars, or kaons, or even hybrid stars where both normal matter and quark matter is formed, or even take neutrons completely out of neutron stars and made these stars completely out of quark matter, the so-called strange quark stars. So these are the kind of models, this is the kind of physics that we're trying to probe. So the general consensus, yes?
Are all these assuming isotropic pressure? Because I remember some people were working on models with magnetic fields or something may cause anisotropy.
Yes. Yes, there are ways to look into anisotropy in the evolution, though in general, most of these models assume isotropic pressure. And there are general arguments for why the amount of anisotropy that could be there will not affect the evolution, will not affect the kind of signals that we get from these systems. So the general consensus before we got the detection was that with a few bright sources, we could measure the tidal deformability, we could measure this parameter that depends on the equation of state. But then the next question is, does that mean we can measure the composition of neutron stars? So here is the dimensionless tidal deformability as a function of the mass. And this is basically the relation that you are looking for. So for different equations of state, different equations of state models, you get a different curve of the tidal deformability as a function of the mass. And here I am plotting in red AP4, which is a very normal standard equation of state, assuming normal matter. And in blue, I don't know if you can see the blue here, is another normal matter equation of state. So it assumes the same, very similar composition inside neutron stars.
What do you refer to as normal matter?
Neutrons, electrons, protons, and muons. So no phase transition inside the star.
All those curves are one model, you would have thought that there's some uncertainty in what the prediction would be. Is that, do you have a sense as to how
wide is compared to the spread between the curves? There are families of models that do have some spread. So a lot of these models have tunable parameters for various parameters that we don't know very well experimentally, and we can change their values. So these models are constructed with a specific value of all these parameters. They don't have any uncertainty. But within the same family of equations of state, you could have models that are close by changing some of the tunable parameters.
But for example, some of your models were mean field models, and the mean field approximation probably has errors in it. So do they estimate that kind of thing?
Not to my knowledge, no. They try to construct specific models with specific assumptions, and then they vary these and get different models. But the point here is that in between those two that are models that assume normal matter, you have a model that assumes the creation of hyperons called H4, and a model that predicts just strange quark stars, the green, which are stars that have no neutrons, just made of quark matter. So the point is that even if we go ahead and measure the tidal deformability, It's not clear that we'll be able to say something about the composition of neutron stars. We made some measurement of teleformability, say here. This can be consistent with a very wide range of models of different, of wildly different compositions inside neutron stars. So the thing I wanted to go back and take a look at is, if you go back to all these equation state and all the different models that you have out there, to what extent can gravitational waves actually give us a measurement of the composition inside neutron stars? So the way I try to do that is by taking pairs of equations of state that are as similar as possible, but differ in one critical aspect, and that critical aspect being the internal composition inside the stars they form. So in this case, this is an example pair. S5 is a normal matter equation state, meaning neutrons, electrons, protons, and muons. And this one is a corresponding equation of state, which at some point inside the star has a phase transition and starts forming kaons. So the rough idea is that if you have a gravitational wave signal and you have two models, one that are as equivalent as possible, but one predicts a kaon condensate and one doesn't, if the former fits the data better, then you have some indication that the signal you just observed was emitted by two neutron stars that had kaons in their interiors. So this is the rough idea, and you can do this many times with many pairs of equations of state, effectively trying to marginalize over the uncertainty over equations of state, trying to signal out just the effect of kaons in equations of state. And the result is that advanced LIGO will be able to fairly confidently detect or rule out strange quark stars at a moderate signal-to-noise ratio of 20, and mass is typical for what you expect from neutron stars in binaries, while for hybrid quark stars, things are slightly less optimistic. You need a slightly louder signal to be able to detect them or rule them out. So the signal we observed in August had a signal-to-noise ratio of 33, so it's not impossible that we'll see one signal that is that loud, so would be unexpected probably.
Sorry, for 1708-17, what was the signal to noise ratio?
33.
Okay, so I was in that range. So is it ruled out then?
We'll get back to that. Well, for kaons and hyperons, things are less optimistic because you need a fairly strong signal and high masses.
Question is very relevant. How do you quantify, how do you exclude the model if you don't know what the error bars on the model are?
Because you have various models that depend on some parameters that you can change. And depending on the parameters, you can get a different model.
Yes, but how there must be a theoretical error bar in the predictions of each model. If the error bar is a factor of 10, then how do you tell two models apart? If you cannot quantify what systematic error, theoretical prediction error bar is, how can you say conclusively that the two can tell apart? The one model is excluded versus the other.
So the way to tackle this systematic uncertainty is to marginalize over it. So for these results, what happened is not that we took two models and compared them and said, we can tell them apart or not, because the models themselves are very uncertain. But what we did is take a large number of pairs. So vary these parameters, take a large number of models within their systematic uncertainties, and take all these pairs and see where we can tell them apart. Effectively, if you do that, you marginalize over the systematic uncertainty in the models. And what remains in the end after you've marginalized over this error is the true differences between the equations of state. And the true difference is the kaons, is the presence of the kaons.
I think I would agree with that if the only uncertainty was not knowing the values of the parameters. But supposing in your plot of the predictions of these curves, these functions and models, you really had to draw the curve as wide as the error in the prediction, the theoretical prediction for the model, then even for one specific set of parameters. And if they were all fat, so that they all overlap, then you wouldn't really be able to distinguish where you were, because you really wouldn't know where in that fat curve you were supposed to live. And marginalizing wouldn't help that, right? You just really wouldn't know what the prediction is.
But if you take a lot of them, if you take a lot of models within this uncertainty, and not just models that are used with mean field theory, you can also take other types of approximations, then this error eventually, after you take a lot of models, this error would eventually cancel out between the different pairs, the different predictions, and what will remain in the end is the difference between the equation of state, the true difference between the equation of state in terms of the counts in this case.
I would say that the argument you're giving is that if it were true that for any one set of parameters I knew exactly what the prediction was, then you're saying I can infer, and different stars might have different values of the parameters. I can winkle out what the parameters were for any one system by looking at a lot of systems. I think that's what you're saying, right?
Yes.
But I'm saying a different thing. I'm saying that supposing it's true that for, say there were no parameters, say that the model was, but it's a mean field calculation with one set of parameters that you can't vary. But because the mean field approximation is not a good approximation, it gives you a really crappy prediction for what your curve is.
Mm-hmm.
Then no matter how many systems you looked at, you couldn't improve on that, right? Because you really wouldn't know what the prediction is in that case.
In that case, then if you don't believe any of them, if you don't believe that the models are even reasonable or even correct, then yes, you would probably have a problem because you're comparing bad models to begin with the data. But the way to go around this is not by looking at just mean field theory models, but also other types of models that have different types of systematics and different types of systematic trends in how they mischaracterize the pressure, they mischaracterize the tile deformability. So this kind of analysis cannot be done with two equations of state and cannot be done with two equations of state or with pairs of equations of state all calculated with the same method. You need to take a large number of different methods so you can probe different types of systematic errors in the relations.
Do the sellers of the models give you some sort of a handle as to how accurate that they...
Sorry?
So the people that are selling you models, do they give you some sort of a sense as to how wide the error in the predictions are?
Usually what they do is they give you tables of models, but they give you a lot of models where they vary the different parameters, and you can have many examples of equations of state predicted within their family of equations of state.
So when you marginalize over models, so how do you pick the measure over that space of models? I'm missing something, I think.
Yes, so picking the models is probably the largest problem here, because all you can do is pick the models that nuclear physicists have provided you with, and picking the models that fit the criteria I needed here, which is models that are as identical as possible apart from the internal composition.
So if some model builder gives you like 500 models for his particular construction, then his model will be favored in this calculation?
Oh no, they're not weighted by how many you have. So
right, that was my question about the measure on that space.
Oh, what you do is you take all of them and compare them. And it does not matter the density of models within the space. What matters is the common predictions that all these models make. And you're looking for something that is common within the various numbers of models you have.
You pick out the kaons. What about the pi rho omega phi, which are made just of uptown quarks? What about, why are they not considered?
Pions? The reason...
Pions, rows, omegas, phis, all these light measures.
The reason they're not considered I was not able to find pairs of equations of state that have the criteria I needed, which is equations of state that are similar, that one of them includes a phase transition, and that they agree with the two solar mass measurement of neutron stars.
Kaon is a strange quantum state.
Mm-hmm. But there are still some models that are viable models. And you can take them and analyze them.
How hard is it to do some microscopic simulations for like a condition similar to the interior of the nuclear of the neutron star to find what equation of state to do or to use, like assuming given number of species?
Well, the problem is that you don't know what the physics you obey is. The densities are so high and the temperature is so low that we have no way of probing this in experiments. You actually don't know how they interact, how matter in this form interacts. So you don't know what the equations you're solving are.
I mean, microscopic simulations, like you pick like a very small batch and you just use whatever electron.
You mean first principle QCD calculations?
Exactly.
Yeah, you can do some things and they are restricted in their applicability computational wise. For example, most of these equation state I have here only assume two nuclear interactions because it's not computationally feasible to do three nuclear interactions in this case. If you notice, this is the only one that includes only neutron star. The reason is that this is the only equation of state that assumes three nuclear interactions. And because it's so computationally intensive, they could only do it for neutrons, pure neutron matter. So these are difficult calculations.
What do these initials mean, SHF, BHF?
Oh, there are the different types of approximations, different number names for the potentials they assume, and different abbreviations for the techniques that they use. Usually they're names of people, apart from RMF, which is relativistic meaningful theory. Okay, at this point I will start skipping material, which I was to have done about 20 minutes ago. And I will show you our measurement for teleformability for 1708-17. The two teleformabilities of the two stars, we were not able to make an unambiguous detection of tides, an ambiguous detection of teleformability. You see that this is consistent with zero, which is why I'm saying that from a gravitational wave perspective, we don't even know that these are neutron stars. They could be black holes. But despite that, we do have a rough bound to the neutron star radius of about 14 kilometers, and there's a lot of improvements of this analysis on the way. For example, this result did not assume that the two neutron stars come from the same equation state, which hopefully is true, but we did not assume it all the way back in October, and we have a number of more realistic analysis that can probe more realistic equation state. Another thing we're trying is the question about spins. So this analysis so far assumed non-spinning bodies. So these teleformabilities are calculated assuming slowly spinning bodies.
So these are lambda, what does it measure exactly, this parameter?
The deformation of the two stars. So the equation I wrote a while ago, the quadrupole moment, is teleformability times the tile field. So the larger lambda is, the easier it is to deform the star.
Is there a time lag, though? I mean, between the you know the quadrupole versus the shear, or no?
Early on, in the adiabatic approximation, there shouldn't be any. Later on, as they get closer and closer together, there probably is. So this is a source of error in the models, and there are some ideas, some approaches of how to include this error and assume that the tides are not as adiabatic as and nicely behaved as that.
But most of your sensitivity, though, you know, to the deformability comes from the late in spiral, where the errors you're saying might be worse.
The point where this matters is, let's say, the late, even late in the late.
Okay.
So very close to the end, very close to merger. There's still a good chunk of the late in spiral where the tides should be adiabatic. Okay, so to sum up, the latent spiral is where we measure the tidal deformability and we start probing the internal composition of neutron stars. And this is where nuclear physics starts kicking in into the system. And again, at this point, we need accurate waveforms for what the signal looks like in order to analyze it. And finally, in the 7 minutes I have, we'll give you a crash course on the post-merger, which is what happens after the two neutron stars merge. So after the two neutron stars merge, the whole thing is a total mess. You see that the signal is very complicated, which is why this phase has historically many times been just neglected. But this is a very promising phase because here is where the equation of state differ among each other the most. So roughly speaking, when you have two neutron stars that merge, there are three possible outcomes. The first is that whatever remnant forms after the merger directly collapses into a black hole. It does not survive as a neutron star at all because it's so massive that it can't survive. On the diametrically opposite side, you have a stable or semi-stable neutron star that can survive for some time, that can survive long enough, at least in the center, as a very rapidly spinning neutron star, that can survive indefinitely or for a few minutes or seconds. And in between those two scenarios, you have a neutron star that is originally formed and then eventually collapses into a black hole. So this figure is from a paper that came out after 1708-17 and argues that this is indeed what happened to 1708-17. The remnant survived as a neutron star for a little bit before it eventually collapsed into a black hole. Though, to be fair, this is not a settled debate, and there are different views in the literature, but this is just, there are arguments for in favor of this scenario.
So you're saying that middle thing happens, but eventually it should collapse to a black hole? That's the consensus. And how long does it take for it to collapse to a black hole?
Something of the orders of dozens of milliseconds, or even more, because at some point simulations can stop tracking it, can stop finding what happens.
Consensus is a strong word.
But I'm asking her, I'm not asking you.
She said that it's been unsettled.
Okay. So this post-merger signal, this is what it looks like once you have yet two neutron stars and merge them in a computer and extract the gravitational wave signal. So this is the frequency time decomposition of the signal. In the top, you have the time domain projection, and here you have the frequency domain, so the spectrum of the signal. So the thing to notice is that this is a very complicated signal. Up here is not the nice, simple gravitational wave we're used to seeing from when two black holes merge, but it has a very complicated morphology. This means that it is very difficult, if you wanted to write down an exact model for what it looks like, to predict what the signal emitted from two neutron stars that have merged is. It's very difficult. It's not an easy problem to solve. On top of that, there are a lot of groups doing numerical simulations. They include different amount of physics, different amount of sophisticated evolution, and there's even some uncertainty there that it's not guaranteed that if you take these exact two neutron stars and merge them in nature, you'll get exactly that signal that I have up there. But besides that, there are some things, some very clear things that they agree on. And one of the things that they agree on is that most of the power comes in a very single, almost constant frequency. And this results in a peak in the spectrum, very characteristic peak in the spectrum, that depends on the equation of state of the neutron stars that just collided. The reason is that this frequency is basically the quadrupole moment of the remnant star, which depends on the density, which of course has to depend on the equation of state. So in order to go and use the post-merger to do some physics,
right. Do we know if that's a linear mode of the star, or
there are arguments in general for what this causes it? But yeah, in general, this is very well understood to be the quadrupole moment of the mode of the remnant star. So once you have the two neutron stars colliding, they form some sort of bar, and they orbit around the bar, rotates, and this is what the frequency of these is what causes. What is that? So far, all the analysis I have described have used exact models, have assumed that we know what we're looking for. We're going to analyze the signals. At this point, this is not possible because the signal is so complicated, we cannot model it. So I will, for this, to study this phase, I will describe a slightly different approach using a technique and an algorithm called BayesWave that instead of assuming that you know exactly what the gravitational wave looks like, and this is, you know, a typical gravitational wave from two colliding black holes, instead of assuming you know exactly that, what you do is try to decompose a signal as a sum of some basis functions. And in this case, the basis functions are just sine Gaussians, simple sine Gaussians, whose properties and whose number is allowed to vary in such a way that you get an acceptable fit, an acceptable reconstruction for the signal. And this is how it looks like once you go and do that. So you have a complicated signal in the time domain and in the frequency domain. The black is the injected, the simulated data, so no real data here, and in the time and the frequency domain, and the purple bands are the credible intervals for the reconstruction, for what you think the signal is. And the important thing, of course, by looking at the time domain, is that the frequency of the signal, the characteristic frequency of this, the post-merger oscillation is extracted, is measured very well by the reconstruction. Now, you don't get the entire signal. I mean, you miss things out here, but that's not what you care about. Most of the physics is here. It's not here. So if you take this, you can say something about the equation of state, because that frequency depends on the equation of state, depends on the density of the remnant star. So here's another thing that simulations seem to agree on, that if you have the frequency of this peak, it should correlate to some quantity that characterizes the two neutron stars before they have merged. And here's an example, plotting the frequency as a function of the radius of a 1.6 solar mass neutron star predicted by the equation state you're studying. So what does plot mean? It means that you have two neutron stars, some properties, some masses, and some equation state, and merge them in some simulation and extract the gravitational wave signal. And this is the frequency of the gravitational wave signal. And then you go and plot this as a function of the radius of the 1.6 solar mass neutron star predicted by this equation of state that you had in your simulation. And you do this many times for many different masses and for many different equations of state and find that these points for one value of the total mass of the system fall on approximately a single line. So these black lines here are fit to the relation between the frequency and the radius. And the shaded regions are error bars, how uncertain this relation is. 50-90% error bars. So once you have measured the frequency from a gravitational wave signal, you can go and measure the radius of a star. You can measure how large the stars that how large of a star this equation of state can make. So this is what it looks like. So you have the posterior for the radius of a star. Once you have seen signals from the post-merger of a binary interstar coalescence for different signal-to-noise ratios, so for different strengths of the signal that you're observing. So when the signal is not very strong, the signal-to-noise ratio is 3, the posterior is kind of flat and uninformative, and you don't really get a good measurement. But as the signal becomes louder, starts emerging from the noise, then the measurement becomes more and more tight. You can get a better and better measurement of the radius.
So this is just SNR for the post-merger?
Yes. And this black line here is the injected value, is the correct value that you assumed in your simulation to begin with. And it's totally missed. So the reason that this measurement here of the radius totally misses this is that these relations have some uncertainty. They're fairly good and tight, especially for some total masses, but there is some spread. And that spread is an error. It's a kind of systematic error you need to take into account your analysis. So if you take this error into account, marginalize over it, you end up with another measurement of the radius, which is, of course, wider because you have larger errors, but it is, you know, it's correct.
So which signal to noise is that for?
This it was computed for the signal to noise ratio 10, but you can see that this error is much larger than these errors. So you can make similar things with an SNR 5 or SNR 6, because it's the systematic uncertainty that dominates, not the statistical.
The bottom panel, that's the total remnant mass.
This is the total mass of the neutron stars that merged before the merger.
The published estimated mass is 2.74 solar masses.
Yes.
So you can look over there and see what it is.
What is what?
So we know where to look from the estimated total mass.
But we don't know the radius.
We don't know the radius.
So we can still get a measurement of the radius to within 300 and 700 once we have measured the post-merger. But in reality, for 1708-17, this was the one not-so-bright aspect of it. We did not see any post-merger, even though we looked for it. We were only able to place upper limits on the post-merger emission from the colliding neutron stars. So we can measure the total mass from the in-spiral, but we don't have a measurement of the post-merger, unfortunately. So to sum up, then, this phase.
So is there a reason why you don't have measurements of post-merger?
It's not very loud. It's not strong enough. So even if there is something there, we wouldn't have expected to have seen it in the first place.
And that last thing you showed us, was it for one particular equation of state?
Or yes.
One particular choice?
Yeah. So this plot is for a particular equation of state. This range is for various equations of state of varying stiffness. So it's between 300 and 700 for different types of equations of state. So to sum up this phase, so once the two neutron stars have merged, you have a remnant star that keeps evolving. And that evolution, that signal it emits, offers information about the equation of state, offers good constraints on the radius, that are comparable to the constraints coming from the pre-merger phase. It also comes with the added advantage that it can probe higher densities and higher temperatures that might not be accessible to pre-merging neutron stars. And I argued that to study this phase, you have to employ some data analysis techniques that are non-standard for binary neutron stars and binary black hole coalescences.
The one that you saw, where you were not able to see that final phase, how close would it have had to have been in order for you to get a signal noise ratio of 5?
About a factor of 3, because at design sensitivity we would have seen it. Design sensitivity is a factor of 3 away. So for most reasonable equations of state, we would have seen 1708-17 at design sensitivity. There are some very soft ones, where the peak of the post-merger spectrum has really high frequencies, and we have still missed it. But if nature is more kind than that, then we would have seen it. So I've gone way over time. I'm almost done. I just wanted to give you a brief overview of what the future holds, besides the analysis that LIGO is preparing currently and should be done within a few months or so. But for the future, and for 1708-17, and for the binary stars we'll see in the future, there are a lot of things that we can do better. The first thing, of course, is that at the moment I described properties of three phases, and I described how two of them have been unified due to the existence of models and have been studied together. But eventually, we do want to have a full analysis that uses exact modeling for the pre-merger and some morphologically independent analysis for the post-merger. And if you do that, you will be able to dig deeper into the noise from the post-merger and maybe even see some indication from something happening after 1708-17 merged. That's not a guarantee. It's something that could help the analysis and might lead to better results. What will lead to better results also is including more information, including more modeling, including more prior information in our analysis. At the moment, we are in this kind of extreme cases where the pre-merger is exactly known what the model is. The post-merger is as morphologically independent as we can because we don't really trust much. But it is possible to do something in between and do targeted analysis. If we have some information that we take from simulations or we take from astrophysics and we trust. An example is in this plot again, this blob of power here, the so-called subdominant peak of the spectrum, which a lot of simulations see as happening after the merger of two neutron stars, but they do not seem to agree on what causes it. They do not seem to agree on the physics behind it and the explanation behind it. But if at some point in the future they do agree, then from a data analysis perspective, we can go and include into our analysis and tell our codes that, you know, you've seen this, go look a little before that, a little bit lower frequencies. With this kind of morphology, you should expect to see something else. And we can aid our algorithms this way into finding more things. I'm going way over here, so I'll probably go really fast to the final slides that we can also combine information from many sources, and in the future 170817 will be one of them. And finally, our ultimate goal is to work together with nuclear experiment and combine our measurements for the equation of state with their measurements of the equation of state. And this is from a very recent paper that I think is very interesting, that has the tidal deformability on the y-axis and on the top the radius of a star of the order of kilometers, which has been shown to be very correlated with the neutron skin thickness of lead, which is of the order of femtometers. So quantities different by 18 orders of magnitude obey the same physics, which allow us to go and talk to nuclear physicists and combine our measurements and help each other into understanding the physics of neutron stars. So I will end here because I'm way over time, and thank you. If you have more questions, I'll be happy to take them.
If you have an eccentric merger that isn't so extreme that it's well-separated bursts that sort of mix together, can that look like spin effects? Or can you tell them apart?
You can tell them apart in general because they affect the waveform in different ways. So your case is a small eccentricity where they're not separated, you said, right? Yes, you can still tell them apart. What prohibits you from doing that is technical reasons, that we don't have a model that describes eccentricity and precession at the same time. But when we do have this, we can look into this problem. We have some bounds on the eccentricity of these systems, but they're not very good. We don't expect them to be very eccentric, but they could be, and we want to go look for it.
In the case of the back to the black holes, the six black hole merger events, the best template fit tells you what the mass and spins are of the two black holes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's measured. So knowing that, we know whether the spins are misaligned.
But there are a lot of...
If they look as if they're misaligned.
There are a lot of values of masses and spins that could fit the same signal. The question is not what the best fit is. The question is what kind of parameters are consistent with the signal. And a lot of parameters that do not assume spins or do not assume misalignments are very consistent with the signals, apart from 17, 15, 12, 26, which is the only one that has evidence for spin. Everything else could be completely non-spinning, or everything else could be completely spin-aligned, have spins aligned with the orbital angular momentum.
We can't believe the templates necessarily, as far as the mass and spin values.
Well, you can believe that the system is consistent with precession, but you
are as well.
Of course, always. But you can believe that the system is consistent with precession, but from that, you cannot claim that you know that it is precessing, because it's consistent with non-precession as well.
So let's say that we are really lucky and we see something that is 10 times closer. You talk about analysis of like the intermediate range and the post-merger, like from which part of the signal would you learn more about the equation of state?
The statistical errors from the two phases are equivalent. They're pretty much the same order of magnitude. But then to interpret this, you need to fold in any systematics you have. Currently, the systematics from the post-merger are a lot more severe. So you have to remember the posteriors that become really tight, and you have to widen them because you don't believe the measurement because you have errors. So the post-merger measurement would have to be widened a lot more than the pre-merger measurement because of the systematic uncertainties in the post-merger. The pre-merger has some systematic uncertainties as well, but they're not as severe. You would use, so if you're looking for one answer, is that you would use both of them, but currently the pre-merger would be better.
So I want to get a better understanding of what's the status of what happens after the merger. So so do all simulations that exist, I guess Lewis has told me that some may give you black holes, some may not give you black holes. So I guess I'm just wondering, is it that just you cannot run it long enough to know what happens, or is there a consensus? So
do you want to answer this or should I?
Well, maybe I ask you because you're the speaker. So
okay, so there are two reasons for why the remnants don't collapse. In the simulation, they don't collapse. The first could be that it is just stable and that it's never going to collapse. If the total mass, if the mass of the remnant is below the TuV mass, the equation of state is never going to collapse. If the mass is above, but only slightly above, and could still support it by rotation, it will take a very long time to lose the rotation and collapse. And the simulations can definitely not follow it for years.
Okay.
If on the other hand, it collapses on, say, 1 second or 700 milliseconds or 500 milliseconds, then that we don't know because the simulations cannot track it that far. So it could be a combination of it genuinely not collapsing and or the simulations just are not able to follow it.
And simulations that you are aware of, some of them do see the collapse of the black hole and some of
yes.
them don't see the collapse.
There are many examples of where you can successfully model collapse.
Yeah, so let me just clarify. So there are some that intrinsically, because of physical parameters, they would collapse of a black hole and they all go through. And if provided with the same physics, if we wait long enough, they would collapse of a black hole. The question mark, and this was referring to what Mr. was alluding to, depends on the amount of physics. So now you can have two different simulations that differ in the amount of physics. Mm-hmm. Because, as she said, the pressure rotation support against collapse. But if you have now binary fields in one versus the other one, then the transport angular momentum more efficient because one would collapse maybe in 20 milliseconds, while the other one would go 100 milliseconds. But okay, mm-hmm. the physics that have been put in there is different.
Right. So the query is another uncertain.
So last question.
What was this intriguing thing you said about lead?
Lead?
Something about lead? Surface?
Yes.
Is that some analogy between neutron stars and nuclei? Or what is that?
So this axis here is the neutron skin thickness of an isotope of lead, which means the RMS radius of the protons minus the RMS radius of the neutrons, or whichever is larger. This is called the neutron skin thickness of a nucleus. And this quantity has been shown for a specific description of the properties of dense matter and equations of state. This property has been shown to be very well correlated with the radius of a star predicted by the same equation of state.
By some theoretical understanding, or it's just
given a specific. So these dots are specific equations of state, and with this specific equation of state model, you calculate the skin thickness, and you calculate the radius.
When you say it's shown, is it just an empirical fact? You solve the two
yes.
models, and there seems a correlation. There's no theoretical understanding of why there should be this correlation, or is there some?
There are broad arguments for why certain properties of neutron stars are determined by certain parts of the equations of state. So the radius in general depends on the outer layers of the neutron stars, where the density is lower than the core. So it is very well correlated with other effects that appear at lower densities.
Is it almost as if The lead nucleus is a very small neutron star. Is that what you're telling? Is that what you're telling?
I don't know if I would go that far. I don't know if I would go that far. But they if they have densities that are not too far apart, or if the densities that affect them are correlated, then the physical effects themselves are correlated. I would not call lead a neutron star, though, to be honest.
Okay, on that, let's check,